So that is the perfect tone to bring us to our next session here on today's Gala Seminar, which will focus on central bank digital currency and crypto assets. Ladies and gentlemen, to start this panel discussion today, allow me to invite back on stage, this time to moderate our discussion, Mr. Hyun Song Sin, who is the BIS Economic Advisor and Head of Research with recent focus on digital innovation and the financial system, including the design of central bank digital currencies and their implications for users, financial intermediaries, and central bank. Ladies and gentlemen, excellencies, without further ado, let's welcome our moderator, Mr. Hyun Song Sin.
It's a great pleasure to moderate this panel. I'm Hyun Song Sin from the BIS. And we have a very important and a very pressing issue right now, which is what's going on in crypto. To discuss the issues with crypto, their regulation, and the role of central bank digital currencies, we have an excellent panel. And I would like to invite the panelists to the stage before I introduce them. So Governor Philip Lowe from the Reserve Bank of Australia and Governor Thomas Jordan from the Swiss National Bank. Online, we're also joined by Eddie Yu, the Chief Executive of the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, and Tobias Adrian, who is the Financial Counselor and Director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the IMF. What we will do on this panel is to review some of the recent events in crypto, discuss some of the implications for financial stability, for regulation, for their use, and within that framework, also raise the issue of what role central bank digital currencies may play, both as an alternative to crypto, but also in the longer term. And I think what we've seen in the recent turmoil in the crypto universe is that some of the microeconomic mechanisms that have given rise to stress in the crypto universe are to some extent very familiar from stress episodes in conventional financial markets. So, for example, we have seen how leverage then turns to deleveraging and fire sales, exactly as we would see, as we saw actually during the great financial crisis in 2008. We also saw the implications of maturity mismatch and how that can give rise to run-like phenomena in the crypto universe, again, just like what we would expect in the conventional financial system. And so the regulation of crypto is going to be, is emerging as a very important policy challenge. And there, the principle of same risk, same activity, same regulation is a very important benchmark. But the same activity could mean either in terms of the contractual form, whether it be like a deposit in a crypto bank, or whether it we should interpret same activity in terms of the underlying economic function. So in conventional financial systems, we compare, for example, the giving of mortgage loans by a bank and the way that mortgage-backed securities would perform the same economic function, but in the capital markets. In crypto, most of the assets within the DeFi, decentralized finance universe, tend to be other crypto assets, other crypto coins, and therefore it's a very different economic function rather than what we would expect in a conventional financial system, where there are lenders and borrowers and there are real assets involved. So how we apply the same activity, same regulation, clearly will very much depend on that. Now, is financial stability the only issue? I think probably there are other important policy goals, such as consumer protection, for example, to make sure that there is we can guard investors from deceptive marketing and misleading advertising and so on. In the context of all this, central bank digital currencies loom large, both as a digital asset that is safe, that is trusted, issued by the central bank. But there is a larger set of issues which have to do with the possible role of CBDCs within the broader payment system, both in the domestic context and also in the cross-border context. So what I would like to do is to ask the panelists to provide their initial interventions, and we will go in the order that we see here. So I will first start with Thomas Jordan, then to Phil Lowe, and then to Eddie Yu, and to Tobias. So Thomas.
Thank you, Yun. Well, let me start by thanking the Indonesian presidency, and in particular my friend, Governor Perry, and the Bank of Indonesia for organizing this seminar. It's really a great pleasure for me to be here and to share some insights on CBDCs and crypto assets from the perspective of the Swiss National Bank. Well, the topic is very timely and important. In recent months, crypto assets have experienced a serious setback. The overall market capitalization has decreased by more than 60% from the peak in 2021, and crypto markets are experiencing severe stress. Some so-called stablecoins and crypto service providers have run into difficulties. Indeed, people who have invested their life savings into crypto assets are now facing heavy losses. For many observers, these developments have not been entirely surprising. Structural flaws in crypto assets have been evident for quite some time. From a central bank perspective, the main concern is that these stresses in crypto markets could spill over to traditional finance and negatively impact financial stability. So far, this has not been the case, but risk should not be underestimated, as developments in crypto assets can be very rapid. Today, I would like to point out three lessons learned from these recent developments. First, for regulation of crypto assets. Second, for the role of central banks in the monetary and payment system. And third, for central banks' explorations of CBDCs. So let me start with the regulation and supervision of crypto assets. Digital intermediaries and crypto assets aim to cover the entire spectrum of activities currently provided by the traditional financial service industry. These include payments, raising capital, savings and investing, and lending and borrowing. But the recent events show that the crypto financial system also exhibits the same risks as in traditional finance, such as deleveraging, interconnectedness, contagion, runs, fire sales, and also fraud, evasion, and even manipulation. Now, in response, public authorities are stepping up their regulatory and supervisory efforts. The authorities have made it clear that crypto assets and the provision of digital financial services more generally must be brought within the regulatory perimeter. The application of existing regulatory standards according to the same activity, same risk, same regulation principle, and you already mentioned that, must be the starting point in this regard in order to achieve the same regulatory outcome. In order to apply existing standards, it is important to categorize crypto assets but also related activities. For example, a debate is currently taking place about whether stable coins and their issuers should be regulated as money market funds, as payments system, as deposit-taking institutions, or as a combination of these. This categorization is relevant as it determines what approach is adopted to mitigating run risk and promoting stability. More generally, the categorization will be important to determine how the same activity, same risk, same regulation principle should be applied. Of course, and you also already mentioned that, some adjustment may be needed when applying standards in order to factor in the unique features of crypto assets. Many crypto arrangements are borderless by nature, and some of them lack a clear legal entity that can serve as a regulatory entry point. Such arrangements challenge our traditional domestic structures for regulation and supervision. I'm convinced that close cooperation is the key to designing crypto asset regulation that allows us to harness the benefits of these new technologies while mitigating the related risks. The Financial Stability Board is playing a critical role in coordinating regulatory efforts between domestic authorities and international standard setters, and has recently communicated its stance on the regulation of crypto assets. Developing a sound regulatory framework for crypto assets should not be seen as an impediment to innovation. Rather, it will help to avoid regulatory arbitrage and facilitate the adoption of new technologies. Let me now turn to the second lesson learned. The stresses in crypto markets remind us that the role of central banks in the monetary and payments system remains as relevant as ever. Let me elaborate. Stablecoins perform an important function in the crypto ecosystem as a bridge between crypto assets and traditional finance. Stablecoins import the stability of an established unit of account. To put it in another way, they leverage the credibility of sovereign currencies into the crypto world. However, the demise of Terra and the difficulties faced by other stablecoins have shown that stablecoins are prone to run risks when users lose trust. Also, stablecoins are highly concentrated today, and there is the risk that stablecoins arrangements are fragmented in walled gardens. This is a reminder that central banks are uniquely positioned to play a, or even the critical role in the monetary system. They issue central bank money, which defines the unit of account and which is used to settle transactions between financial institutions on a trusted payment infrastructure. This payment backbone establishes a level playing field for private firms and facilitates private sector innovation. Many central banks, including the Swiss National Bank, are in the process of upgrading these payment systems to enable faster payments between individuals. The results have been very encouraging. For example, in India and Brazil, where upgrades have helped to reduce fees and improve financial inclusion. This modernized payment system can also be linked across borders. This could contribute to the G20 initiative on improving cross-border payments. This brings me to the third lesson, which concerns digital money issued by central banks or CBDC. The flaws in crypto markets should not lead us to dismiss the innovative potential of technology behind crypto assets. Actually, many central banks are exploring how they can harness the benefits of the technology for the introduction of CBDCs. The Swiss National Bank has been focusing on wholesale CBDCs. These are CBDCs which would be available to financial institutions that already have direct access to reserve accounts and central bank payment systems. Potentially, such access could be expanded to regulated financial institutions from abroad and also to other payment service providers. We have explored domestic and international use cases for wholesale CBDC in experiments conducted with the BIS Innovation Hub. We We found that settling tokenized assets and cross-border transactions with wholesale CBDCs is not only technically feasible, but also efficient. However, our experiments also show that the most important challenges are of a legal, governance, and policy-related nature. Central banks will have to carefully evaluate the policy implications of CBDCs for monetary and financial stability. These implications will depend heavily on a specific CBDC's design. To be useful, CBDCs will also have to be embedded in existing payments and settlement infrastructures and markets. More generally, the cross-border use of CBDCs should have implications or could have implications for the international monetary systems, and these need to be better understood. I'm sure that Tobias will go into that. Whether central banks will eventually decide to introduce a CBDC, either for retail or wholesale purposes, will depend, among other things, on developments in traditional payment systems and in private digital currencies. In conclusion, let me emphasize that it's important to bear alternatives in mind when examining the case for a CBDC. While some central banks may decide to issue a wholesale or retail CBDC, others may opt to improve traditional payment system instead. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. You've given us a lot of food for thought, and we will come back to those. Let's move to Governor Lowe. Phil, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Sean, and thank you very much to my great friend, Governor Perry, for the invitation to be here today and for your fantastic hospitality in Bali over the last couple of days. It's been a real pleasure to be here. As Thomas said, the questions you've set for us in this session are really timely and they're important, but they're also really hard. What's the future for central bank digital currencies and crypto, and how should they be regulated? But because they're hard, my instinct is to look back at history to see whether there are any lessons for us. And when I do that, I found three lessons that are relevant. The first is that what our societies use as money is determined by the technology we have at hand. Once upon a time, we used gold and silver coins. Then we used paper banknotes. In Australia, we use fantastic polymer banknotes. And most money today actually is digital. It sits in bank accounts and it can be moved between bank accounts instantaneously. So the nature of money changes with the nature of technology. The second observation from history is that privately backed money can work for a while, but it usually ends in disaster. Usually ends in financial stability and a loss of confidence. People value money backed by the state, whether it's banknotes issued by the central bank or deposits in private banks underpinned by government-endorsed deposit insurance. And in wholesale markets, financial institutions want to settle in central bank money, not in private money. They value safety, stability, and finality. So public money is generally preferred to private money. A third lesson from history is that new technologies drive waves of innovation, but they also drive waves of speculation. And those waves of speculation often end up in people losing money, particularly people who are not well informed. I think we've seen examples of that just recently. So they're the three lessons from history, and I've been thinking about how to apply those to the difficult questions that we have to consider today. It's pretty clear that new digital technologies will once again change the nature of money in our societies and how that money is transferred. No doubt there's more innovation to come and we need to be prepared for it, but it's at this stage I find it really hard to know exactly what the future is going to look like, especially in countries like Australia where we already have a very fast, real-time, flexible payment system where money is moved instantaneously between any two bank accounts in the country. The system meets the needs of most people, and we're seeing really good innovation in an Australian domestic fast payment system that meets the needs of most people. but it's certainly possible that new forms of money will develop. If they do, they're going to need to provide better services than the payment system we already operate from bank account to bank account. And it's possible new forms of money will do that. It'll offer better financial inclusion. Not everyone has a bank account. And the cost of payments to merchants is still very high. Credit card payments are very expensive for merchants, and even debit card payments cost merchants a large amount. And as we all know, the cost of cross-border payments is really high. So new forms of money can help here. And I think it's also quite possible that new forms of money will offer better consumer experience than passing pieces of paper or pieces of polymer around or moving money between bank accounts. So it must be the case that new forms of money will emerge that offer better solutions to the ones we have now. In particular, I think it's probable that at some point the banknotes that we hold in our physical wallets will be complemented by some form of digital token that we hold in a digital wallet. And if this is how things evolve, the question we've been thinking about is, what should be the nature of those digital tokens in the digital wallet? My view is that if these tokens are going to be used widely by the community, they're going to need to be backed by the state or prudentially regulated, just as we regulate bank deposits. At a really high level, I think you can think of two possibilities here. One is that these tokens are backed by the central bank. So they're a central bank digital currency that's of retail form. So that's one possibility, and some of us are exploring that. But the other possibilities that we're exploring is that these tokens are issued by the private sector, not by the central bank. But the tokens are backed by very high collateral, perhaps central bank deposits or government securities, or that the issuing authority is actually regulated like a bank. So there could be private tokens rather than a central bank digital currency. Both possibilities can obviously work. I tend to think that the private solution is going to be better if we can get the regulatory arrangements right. That's because the private sector in the end is going to be more innovative than the central bank. It's going to be better at innovating and designing features for these tokens. And there are also likely to be very significant costs in the central bank setting up a digital token system. I think it's going to be better for the private sector to manage those costs. There are also quite a lot of risks here and operational issues. Thomas was kind of referring to these with at the wholesale level, but if the central bank were to issue tokens that set in digital wallets, just as we issue banknotes in our physical wallets, there are a lot of operational issues, there are a lot of risk management issues, privacy, AML, is a long list. In the end, I think the private sector is going to be better at doing that than the central bank. But if we are to have a system of privately issued tokens, then the regulatory system needs to be really strong. And I don't think any country has a sufficiently strong system at the moment. In Australia, we don't. We're looking to put in place it, but we're still not there. People need to have confidence in these tokens. They need to be confident that they're going to be repaid, and they're going to be confident that tokens aren't counterfeit, just as they need to be confident that the banknotes aren't counterfeit. It'll also be important that these tokens are interoperable, just as you can use a bank-issued card at any terminal in the country and move money between any two bank accounts in the country. We'll need these tokens to be interoperable so that a token issued by one bank can be used at another bank. So in my view, it's still too early to know whether central banks should issue a retail central bank digital currency. It's possible, but it may well be better and more efficient to have these tokens issued by the private sector. I feel like there's a stronger case for central banks to issue a wholesale central bank digital currency. Thomas talked about this. These wholesale central bank digital currencies could be a useful complement to our existing RTGS systems. We're exploring with various entities how they could be useful in the settlement of trade flows, in cross-border payments and syndicated loans. And they could also be helpful in developing new markets for tokenized assets. One example that people in Australia are exploring is tokenized assets of mineral resources in the ground, and that somehow a central bank digital currency at the wholesale level could help in trading and development of those markets. So I think it's quite likely that in time we will issue some form of digital currency for wholesale settlements and it'll complement the RTGS system. The third lesson from history that I mentioned at the outset was that periods of innovation tend to be associated with periods of speculative behaviour as people fear missing out on the next big thing. Now, I think we've seen this recently with some of the speculative interest in crypto that's not backed by any particular asset. Now, I really hesitate to use the term cryptocurrency, as most crypto doesn't have the characteristics of a currency. It's not low cost, it's not widely accepted medium of exchange, and it's not a reasonable store of value. We've just seen 70% declines in value, so I don't think we should be talking about cryptocurrencies. In fact, many examples of unbacked crypto seem to be little more than forms of speculation to me. The crypto provides very little utility to its owners, other than the ability to sell the crypto to somebody else, hopefully at a higher price, or to buy another form of crypto. So the underlying utility, at least for many of these crypto, I don't like using the word assets, but because I don't think they're assets either. So we can't rule out the possibility that people will eventually find using these various forms of unbacked crypto useful for making everyday payments, but I'm really skeptical that they will. Most of these crypto examples, the prices are volatile, and there's quite a lot of problems with the scalability of the technology. It can be used in small closed-loop systems, but there are problems. So I think it's unlikely that these various crypto things, not assets or currency, will be used as a form of money. But if they did, then we'd have to be confronting a whole series of very difficult issues. So I don't think that we should be thinking of currency or assets, but they do need regulation. And I think the main focus needs to be on consumer protection. People need protection, they need education, people need to understand what they're buying and what they're not buying, and that they're protected from scams. We need to deal with AML issues, which are really serious in this space, and we need to deal with privacy issues. So there's a lot of consumer protection issues to work through, and we also need to understand the implications for broader financial stability. I know this is something that the Indonesian G20 presidency is focused on. We need to understand. At the moment, I'm not particularly concerned about it. My main concerns are really consumer protection and making sure that people who are not particularly well informed don't lose money. The final point I wanted to make is that the one piece of the crypto landscape where I think there is real promise is in stable coins that are linked to the value of our national currencies. I think it's quite possible that these stable coins will form the basis of privately issued tokenized money. If that's how things develop, I think it's quite possible, then we need to have a first-class regulatory regime where these stable coins are effectively regulated like bank deposits. We regulate private money in banks. We should ultimately regulate private money that's a stable coin that sits in our digital wallets as well. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you very much, Phil. So let's now move on to our two virtual participants. We'll go first to Chief Executive Eddie Yu. So Eddie, over to you for your opening remarks.
All right. Thanks, Yuen. First of all, I would like to thank Perry for the invitation. I very much would like to be in the beautiful island of Bali, but unfortunately, I can't. And today, I would like to focus my comments on three main areas. One, the risk brought by cryptos or crypto things, as Phil said, and also DeFi. And second, how we should manage the risk through regulation. And thirdly, the role of CBDCs in all these new developments. But I would like to say, I would like to start by just saying that despite the Terra Luna incident, I thought that the crypto or DeFi developments won't just diminish. They might be held back, but they won't disappear because the technology and the business innovation behind all these developments are actually likely to continue and will grow further in our future financial system. There are many benefits brought by DeFi before I talk about the rest. Let's say permissionless and non-custodial means that you can potentially cut out the intermediaries and cut costs. The composability feature means that you can actually build what you want just based on others' work in an open source environment and innovate, thereby promoting innovation and of new services. But of course, despite these benefits, there are new risks. And Phil and Thomas has talked about some of them, like market integrity, including AML, fraud, investor protection, et cetera. Like the financial stability risks of these DeFi platforms, including the familiar run risk or leverage risk. But there are also new risks coming out from these platforms, things like the coding and cybersecurity risk because of the extensive use of smart contracts. And also there are concentration risks because despite what the name suggests, the decision powers is actually very often concentrated in a few nodes operated by a few entities like the validators or those holding the governance tokens. But the third risk is something that I'm more concerned about, which is the potential spillovers to the financial system. This risk arises from the increasing connectedness between the DeFi cryptos and the traditional financial markets. And the spillover can come through two channels, stablecoins, which serve as a bridge between DeFi and traditional finance, or it could be through banks, which provide financial services to the crypto companies and also acting as the direct linkage between the crypto wallets and the bank accounts. So despite the fact that crypto and DeFi has a lot of benefits and they will bring about financial innovation, it's important that we also need to manage those risks through regulation. And there are two areas that you can regulate. One is on-chain activities and the other is off-chain. The latter off-chain activities is actually a lot easier. And this is where I suggest we can start with in four areas. One is the asset itself, for example, stable coins, which Thomas and Phil has talked about in terms of the great need for regulation, and I won't repeat. Second is the trading platform or some of the centralized exchanges, which is where crypto interacts with the investing public very often, things like Coinbase or Binance. I think that they should be regulated. In Hong Kong, we will soon have a new legislation regulating these trading platforms, both from the AML CFT perspective and also from market integrity angles. But we need all other jurisdictions, major centers, to have similar regulations because these platforms and operators are extremely mobile. They can go from Hong Kong to Singapore to London or to Cayman Islands in one go. The third area is the interface with the regulated financial entities, including banks, or the so-called on-ramping and off-ramping activities, where banks should be required to manage the risk from direct exposures and also when they provide services to clients or even, in trading or custody in both crypto and DeFi. And fourth and final is investor protection, including the need for suitability tests when banks are selling crypto-related products to their customers or even restrictions on advertising to retail investors. But down the road, regulation has to be extended directly to some of these DeFi platforms, although it's very challenging because of the decentralized and globalized nature of these platforms. But it's necessary because like what I mentioned earlier, the decision powers are very often very concentrated in a few entities, validators, developers, or governance token holders. And we need to find a way to creatively identify and regulate these entities or people in a global way. So we need a very globally coordinated approach in order for regulation to be effective. And I've talked quite a lot about the need for regulation, but we should understand and appreciate that the DeFi and the blockchain protocol can also inspire financial innovation, not just in DeFi lending or yield farming, which only service the crypto industry. But in time, I think it will potentially offer innovative solutions relating to activities in the real world, or traditional finance. For example, the blockchain technology can allow the use of smart contracts to execute payments for bonds on, or other financial assets in future, especially if they are tokenized. And it could also allow the fractionalization of asset ownership, for example, in art, in real estate, or in other traditional assets. And if we believe that cryptos and DeFi ecosystem will continue to develop, a further question to ask is whether DeFi or crypto development will be better or worse off with sovereign money in the form of CBDC. And for that, my answer is that it will be better. For DeFi to develop or even become more mainstream, I think three elements are needed. One is a more robust and mature underlying technology. Second is innovative business solution. And the third one is, very importantly, trust in the platforms. And I will argue that in money and payments, central banks remain the best placed institution to provide the trust even in this new age. And as in traditional finance, private or commercial money will always have to find a way to connect back to public money. And because after all, trust is the foundation of any financial platform. So public money or the ability to be converted back to public money can carry that trust through good and stressful times. And as I mentioned earlier, DeFi currently has two channels to connect back to traditional finance, stable coins and banks. But in fact, if you think about it, for these on-ramp, off-ramp activities, CBDC could in theory make it easier and also provide more confidence for users if it were to serve as a link or bridge. The use of CBDC can also build in stability for these DeFi ecosystem, avoid the systemic stress that may be caused by the failure of any major private money provider. And that in turn could provide more comfort for regulators who are concerned about the spillover effect of DeFi to traditional finance. But I can of course understand that from the perspective of those operating in the DeFi world, they may be a little more skeptical because the idea of decentralized finance is not to have any centralized payment authority. They thought that it might stifle innovation. They thought that it might take away some of the features that they like in DeFi, like anonymity, because if CBDC and traditional or central bank instruments were to be used in these platforms, there will be AML requirements. It's still very early days and DeFi space still needs to mature and CBDCs are only still being explored by central banks. Although I would say that the CBDC projects that we are exploring through the BIS Innovation Hub fits very well with the current developments in DeFi platforms, including, for example, under Project Jura that SMB operates. It involves wholesale security settlement, asset tokenization under Project Genesis, or the use of DLT or CBDC for cross-border payment and under Enbridge that the HKMA has participated. So overall, I do see a lot of benefits to integrate the CBDC developments into the involvement of the crypto and DeFi platforms, provided that the risks arising from these platforms can be properly managed, which in turn will depend on the evolution of the regulatory landscape for DeFi. And this last point is very important because if we allow CBDC to be used in some of these platforms, we might run the risk of actually being seen as legitimizing or even endorsing these platforms where if they're not properly regulated, illicit activities will happen or where investors might suffer very huge loss. Again, it's still very early days for both DeFi and CBDC. While I talk about the need to properly regulate crypto and DeFi and also to explore the use of CBDC, I should say that it's actually extremely challenging to get the balance right between regulation, when and how and what. And also between regulation and the need to promote innovation. If we regulate too soon, central banks could be criticized as stifling innovation in the creative space. But if we regulate too late, investors might get hurt and lose money, and some of these platforms might get too large, and it becomes quite difficult to regulate. And the how is also difficult because we need to find ways to effectively regulate DeFi. How can we drive a globally coordinated approach in order for that to be effective? And for CBDCs, should they be used to complement all these new developments? Or as I said earlier, will we be seen as legitimizing some of the platforms that offer highly risky products to the public? So these are all open questions that we should collectively think about on how best to proceed. And these are already pursued in some of the international platforms like the BIS, the IMF, and also the FSB. And I think we need faster speed in deliberations and also more conviction in really collectively putting some of the recommendations like stablecoin regulation or central exchange regulation, put them into implementation, put them on the ground, and not just about discussion. And that will actually be enable us to catch up with the speed of development in these fast emerging platforms. So I'll stop at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Eddie, for those very insightful remarks. So let's go to Tobias for your opening remarks. Tobias, thanks for joining us so late in Washington.
Well, thank you so much, Yun, and let me thank Governor Perry and the Bank of Indonesia for this wonderful event. I apologize for not being able to participate in person. I would love to be there with you. I will focus my remarks on central bank digital currencies, policy objectives for CBDC design, cooperation among central banks, and then I will say a little bit about what we are doing at the IMF. In terms of policy objectives, in our view, there's no one-size-fits-all for CBDCs. There are many different policy objectives that can be pursued with CBDCs. And different countries have different levels of payment systems and digitalization. Some examples of central bank objectives for CBDCs are increasing financial inclusion, promoting competition in payment systems, or enhancing cross-border payments. And so depending on the technological state of a country and the policy objectives, the design of CBDC across countries could be quite different. In general, we feel that the central bank has to work closely together with the private sector, and there has to be a good understanding of what is the role of the central bank versus the private sector. For example, it must be very clear who does what and how it is being done in a safe fashion, such as who's operating ledgers and updating ledgers, how is user acquisition being governed, who does KYC, customer due diligence, how is governance defined, what is execution, and what is oversight. So many details are to be sorted out by each country. Central banks will have new roles. CBDCs challenge central banks as they get potentially closer to households and corporations in terms of interacting with them. Central banks should design CBDCs in a dynamic way with new features, technologies, and use cases even after going to production. But of course, central banks have traditional roles to play as well as guardians of the safety of the financial system and the payment system. We are in favor of establishing multilateral platforms for CBDCs across border. And Eddie already talked about some of the experiments that the BIS is doing together with central banks on developing such platforms. The objectives are to overcome settlement risks, shorten transaction chains, lower FX conversion costs, and reduce compliance costs while preserving data sovereignty. Multilateral platforms for CBDCs can be leveraged to improve economic outcomes. Increasing access to the new platforms and leveling the playing field may yield competition and lower costs. Multilateral platforms are not per se about technology, or not just about technology. They are really about market design, risk management, and safety net features, as well as, so the governance around these platforms is extremely important. So setting up governance, harmonizing domestic rules and legislation, as well as working with the political economy in each country, are first order challenges here. but public policy should develop ambitious solutions. Cooperation among central banks and international organizations will be fundamental to achieve this. Let me now turn to strengthening cooperation among central banks on CBDC. CBDC development should be a collaborative process among central banks. Two areas where collaboration among central banks is needed the most is including these multilateral platforms, but also CFMs. Capital flow measures are extremely important for many countries, and CBDCs have to be compatible with these CFMs. But there are additional aspects. Developing CBDC technologies and sharing lessons. While CBDC objectives and design will be different in each country, the costs of building up CBDC will be lower if done together. CBDC technology should be seen as a public good that could be tailored to each jurisdiction. One could think of setting up CBDC with a modular design, a core determining how issuance and transaction works could be developed commonly among countries. Sharing lessons on what works and what does not, how to incentivize this, the private sector, and what frictions may be more important, how to overcome hurdles, and how to manage risk can be beneficial to all. Cooperation is a must. We are looking into this, but I think there might be other solutions than cooperation and CBDC development. Let me finish with some thoughts on what the IMF is doing in particular in the area of CBDCs. The fund has a mandate to ensure domestic economic financial stability in the member countries and the stability of the international monetary system. And of course, the payment system is at the foundation of the international monetary system. We need to make sure that we achieve the mandate of global international monetary stability as we're transitioning to the digital economy. The international monetary system is facing fragmentation risks that need to be addressed. Risks are in part due to geopolitical factors and in part due to the fragmentation of cross-border payments, as well as the rise of digital money in and of itself. The payment infrastructure allows capital to move and currencies to be converted across borders, and thus underpinning global integration in a stable, efficient monetary systems. Hence, institutions such as the IMF or other international institutions such as the BIS and FSB that were already mentioned are working very much together on policy developments, together with the central banks, on policy developments on CBDCs and how these CBDCs are interacting internationally. In addition, the IMF is providing technical assistance to many countries around the world that have asked for assistance in terms of thinking through policy issues and thinking through design issues. And we are also doing surveillance, both surveillance at the country level on payment systems and CBDCs, as well as at the multilateral level. So let me stop here and turn back to Hyun.
Thank you very much, Tobias. I think we've had a very wide-ranging set of initial comments. What I would like to do now is to turn to the panelists and ask them to address two sets of questions. The first one is on crypto, and the second one is on CBDCs. With respect to crypto, I will ask the same question to all the panelists and ask them just to pick and choose elements of the questions. I guess with the regulation of crypto, one issue is whether regulation itself is going to legitimize the whole universe. I think Phil raised the issue of how we should call them, but I think crypto is a good terminology there, Phil. And I guess to the extent that we regulate them, there are lots of different entry points. So one way, for example, as Eddie mentioned, was to actually regulate the on-chain activity itself. or it could be other entry points through exchanges and other intermediaries, you know, in the crypto universe more broadly. Or should we focus much more on the point of contact between the crypto universe and the conventional financial system? One very important issue that Phil raised was the role of stablecoins. How should stablecoins be regulated? I think we heard Phil's approach to that question, and I think we'd be interested to hear the other panelists as well. So let's start in the same order that we had the opening intervention. So Thomas, let's start with you.
Well, thank you, Yun. Well, I probably shared the view of most of my panel colleagues that the right point would be the activity to activate and not only the contact point. Well, just to give you an example, if you accept deposits or if you provide loans to somebody else, the regulator will come immediately and tell you you fulfill all the conditions to be a bank, and then you have to fulfill the capital, liquidity, etc., all this kind of regulation. So when you really would like to enforce that same risk, same activity, same rule principle applies, then we should go after the activities. And if some activity look like taking deposits or look like making loans, etc., then a very similar approach would be possible. And we cannot say, well, because we are completely different, because we have a different technology, for us the regulation doesn't apply. So we should be regulation neutral, really look at what is the economic activity, what is the economic sense, and then try to adopt that to that. And that brings me to really the stablecoin. So I share Phil's view. If it's really something that is almost the same as a deposit, if it looks like a deposit, then it should be regulated as a bank. It could be in some jurisdictions that it looks more like a money market fund. That we do not have that in Switzerland, so I'm not familiar really with that. But I really believe that if it is as deposit taking, then it should be regulated as deposit taking. So we do not give any regulatory advantage to anybody that just takes uses another technology.
Thank you, Thomas. Phil.
Well, on stable coins, if they're stable in terms of our national currencies, then I think they should be regulated like bank deposits. Or they should have very strong collateral requirements, with collateral being at the central bank or government securities. So I think they're fairly easy to deal with. The other crypto things who have variable prices go up and down, they shouldn't be viewed as currencies, and we shouldn't regulate them like currencies or bank deposits, because they're not that. But they do raise very significant consumer protection and AML issues, and I think that's where the focus needs to be. As you say, the on and off ramps are important for AML and also important for consumer protection. So if people end up wanting to invest in these, invest is a weird word here, but buy these things that his prices go up and down, people should be free to do that, but they should understand what they're doing, and it should be protected against scams and criminal activity. That's where the focus needs to be, on the things whose prices move up and down.
So Phil, if I may just have a follow-up, actually. I think you made a very important point, which was on the self-referential nature of some of the crypto activity. So DeFi very much is about if you like, crypto activity, buying and selling and lending and borrowing other crypto coins. So I guess, you know, one concern that I've certainly heard from some quarters is that if you start regulating them, you will actually give them more credibility, you will legitimize, and so something which is half-baked would actually be more harm than good. Do you have a view on that?
Well, if we start calling them currencies, then I think that's counterproductive. We start treating them like currencies and regulating them in the same way as currencies. I think that's problematic, because they're not that. They're not backed by anything. They're not backed by a central bank, and the price moves around all the time. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't regulate them, because people have an interest in buying them. The prices go up sometimes, and they want to buy them to benefit from the capital gains and perhaps sell them to somebody else. So, like any asset in our economies that people trade, there needs to be regulatory arrangements to protect people.
and to make sure that there isn't criminal activity as well. So that doesn't give them any legitimacy as a currency, but we do need to protect people and provide the infrastructure if people do in the end want to trade these instruments.
Thank you, Phil. So let's move to the virtual participants. So Eddie, could I ask the same question to you?
On stablecoins, same answer. I think same risk, same regulation. And depending on how they're structured, it could be like money market funds, tokenized deposits, or just instruments. You can use different regulations to regulate them. But what we are also doing currently is to see whether there still could be gaps because they can be structured in a very flexible way. So will there be gaps? Will they be able to evade from the current regulations? Do we need an overarching law so that we have more flexibility to capture all stablecoin-like new instruments? This is what we are looking at. As to the approach, as I said, I think it's much easier to start from off-chain, which means, like what you said, the interaction between crypto and DeFi with investors and the public, whether you're talking about centralized exchanges, the interaction with banks or investor protection, even advertising. These are areas that we can have a handle or we know how to regulate. For example, centralized exchanges is a new area, you need new law, but it's the same way that we regulate other trading platforms. Down the road, like Phil said, I do think that we need to regulate the DeFi platforms early rather than later. The main question is how. That is actually very challenging because it's the nature of DeFi is that it's decentralized and you need to identify who is in control and they can go from one jurisdiction to the other. So it's really the how that is a bit puzzling for regulating on-chain, but it's an area that I think collectively we should discuss a lot more in the international forums.
Thank you, Eddie. Tobias, do you have a quick answer to this before we go to the second round?
Yeah, very quickly. So I fully agree that the stablecoins have to be regulated either as banks or as money market funds, depending on the structure. There are different types of structures in stablecoins, but there are certain ones that are bank-like and they are tokenized deposits as well. So different countries have different approaches. Some have literally banking licenses, others have payment licenses that are very similar to banking licenses. On crypto, I think the challenge is that crypto was never conceived for policy purposes. If anything, crypto was conceived to undermine central banks and to be remote from the government. And that is the fundamental challenge in regulating crypto. So I think the approach that others have discussed of regulating the financial market infrastructures that allow access to the crypto universe, I think this is all we can do at the moment. And I think that's exactly the right step. And that is in line with what is discussed at the FSB. Finally, let me just say that the CBDC is really an opportunity, not just to have digital money in terms of a new technology, but really to use technologies for public policy purposes as opposed to crypto. Let me stop here.
Thank you very much, Tobias. Now, moving on to CBDCs. So, Thomas, you mentioned Project Jura, which is the project on multi-CBDC platforms between the Swiss National Bank and the Banque de France. It's one of the BIS Innovation Hub projects. And Eddie, in the Hong Kong center of the BIS Innovation Hub, we also have a multi-CBDC platform called Project Enbridge. If I may ask the two of you, what lessons you have learned from the experiments using those, I think that would be of great interest. And to Tobias, I would like to ask you, from the standpoint of the IMF, what can the multilateral institutions like the IMF and the BIS do in this sphere, in providing, if you like, the basic infrastructure? So let's go first to Thomas.
Thank you, Yun. Well, we had many lessons from this very interesting project, Jura, that we made with the Banque de France. Well, we saw that it's technically feasible. We still have probably to figure out whether the robustness is here, also the scalability. But I would like to mention one point that is really important. So economics and legal issues remain extremely important. So at the end, it's the question whether we are comfortable having a platform where two legal systems are on this platform, whether we accept all these counterparties also as a counterparties at the bank, both at all these central banks. So it's very similar to grant access already today to foreign banks to your payment system. So all these questions are also today already relevant, independent really of the technology. And at the end, it comes always to the point that it's very similar to corresponding banking. And also if you have tokenized the system, at the end, you have really something that comes close to accounting-based system, because we know exactly who is owns the money at a certain point of time, and then the differences becomes relatively small from an economic and legal point of view. Of course, the technology is different. So all these legal and economic questions remain crucial at the end, whether we can go in that direction or not. Thanks.
Thank you, Thomas. Let's move to you, Eddie. The lessons from Project Enbridge.
All right, thank you, Huan. For the Enbridge is already now gone past the proof of concept stage, going into a pilot stage using live and real transactions from 19 participating banks about trade settlement. There are two lessons that we've learned through the process. One is the importance of interoperability. Technical interoperability is easier, but it's important because if you want more central banks to join, to create that network effect, you need the platform to be able to connect with the others. For the Enbridge, the technology is designed in a very flexible way so that it can actually connect with other CBDC platforms, any CBDCs, or even if a central bank doesn't have a CBDC platform, the Enbridge platform can be connected with even the RTGS and the faster payment system of individual jurisdictions. So it's flexible enough. But what's actually more difficult is the business interoperability area, which involves harmonization or at least discussion on governance issues, regulatory compliance like AML, capital control, where different jurisdictions may have different requirements. This is a more difficult part. But what we found actually coming into the live transaction part is that there's a lot of business and policy decisions that you will need to think about when you're really dealing with real transactions. Things like, for example, who will provide liquidity into the platform? Is it the central banks for their own currencies? How can we ensure sufficient liquidity in the FX platform if it's done on-chain? Or whether to allow non-resident banks to access domestic RTGS in order that we can cut out some of the correspondent banks in between to save costs. And there are also business issues like how to break the inertia in terms of using current legacy system. How can we incentivize both the banks and their corporates to use platforms like that? So there's a lot of real issues that you have to tackle when it comes to moving the platform into a stage where you're closer to MVP and commercialization. So I think the Enbridge project holds great promise in making cross-border payment faster and cheaper in future, in solving this long-standing pain, and also not only addressing this current pain, but also serving as a foundation for future payments. But there's quite a lot of business and policy issues that we need to carefully think through when we progress with the project. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eddie. So Tobias, what is the appropriate role for the IMF and the BIS?
Well, I think that the BIS and the IMF are very complementary. We work very closely together, of course, on these policy issues. And the institutional characteristics are complementary. So for example, BIS is really the central bank of central banks, while the IMF also has the finance ministries in its board. So for some questions, some questions about CBDC design, for example, these are broader questions where the finance ministries have a first order say, while other questions are narrower and are more targeted to central banks. Secondly, of course, the IMF is very much focused on policy development, surveillance, and technical assistance. And the bilateral surveillance, such as FSUPs or Article 4s, and the technical assistance are something that is fairly unique to the IMF, while the policy development is shared together with the FSB and the BIS. And of course, the BIS is running technological experiments, which you know, the IMF is not doing. So I think we all have sort of like comparative advantages. We work together, we work very closely with the membership. And I think the punchline is always that we are working to help the membership, right? And to make, to have countries make the right choices, the right policy choices going forward.
Thank you very much, Tobias. We could have gone on for a much longer time, but I see that our time is up. It's been a very rich discussion, and I'd like to thank all the panelists, and we should all give them a great round of applause. Thank you very much.